here is an outline of my talk. I'll first look at the axioms of quantum mechanics, for example, from quantum computation and quantum information by Nielsen and Chuang. Or you can take any other quantum textbook and follow the same thing. Then we'll take a critical look at some of the axioms. And then I will present a partial solutions to the questions that arose. Axiom one. The objective is to categorize a vector in the Hilbert space. And for quantum computation, certainly, we take the Hilbert space to be either C2 or Rn, but it's a finite dimensional Hilbert space. It doesn't have to be.
Why?
Why?
C2 or Rn? I mean, why not C3?
Oh, that doesn't matter. Just finite. That's all I've heard. That's the only thing that I will pick on. Axiom two is that the evolution of a closed system is described by a unitary transformation. In the case of a single qubit, it is assumed that any unitary operator can be realized in realistic systems. Axiom three. Quantum measurements are described by a countable collection of measurement operators. They are such that the sum is equal to one. And the probability that M occurs in state psi is what you've got there. And the state in the system after measurement is that. Axiom four. A composite system of states, rho 1 through rho n, is given by rho 1 tensor product, rho 2 tensor product, rho n. I wanted to have two projectors so that I could continually refer to these. So here is the list of them.
So you mean by measurement, you mean measurement with a particular M?
Mm-hmm. Say that you want to measure the angle that something is oriented in. You put M little pie shapes, and if it falls in that pie shape, you say it's that value.
No, I mean,
I know you know, Mary. Okay. What's this business about a finite dimensional vector space anyway? For spin, we have a finite dimensional vector space. Any particle with spin, however, has an additional characterization in terms of its momentum and its position. Well, what can we do? We can take a countable basis for the Hilbert space, expand any wave function, and truncate. And then invariably, P and Q will take you out of that basis. And this is just a fact that there's no finite basis providing a representation of the CCRs. Well, that raises the question, what is a basis on which we can choose to truncate?
By basis, do you mean rationale? By basis here, do you mean rationale, or do you mean a Hilbert space basis?
Hilbert space basis. Okay. Well, we have the dynamics of a particle in a just wait on that a minute. If you look out there, or look anywhere, you see things and are you only seeing things in black and white? Well, if everybody here was colorblind, they'd say yes. But more than likely, they would say that we've seen colors as well. Well, the colors and the position of your eye and so forth make up a phase space for a photon. And let's take a case of a massive spin particle. Is it enough to say where it is right now? Obviously not, because that would be a very incomplete statement. You have to know where it's going as well. That means that the momentum comes into it. And if it has any spin, you have to do something about measuring the spin as well. And that forms the basis of a phase space for a massive spinning particle. So I'll take the dynamics of a particle in a closed quantum system as given by a unitary operator on phase space. Now, given any operator, any state localized within a certain region of phase space, it may have a slow wave packet spreading. And then we may concentrate on the spin by taking the partial trace. We may concentrate on the momentum by taking a partial trace, and you can take any partial trace you want. You may not get a unitary operator this way. The unitarity may be contrary to this localization. So that brings up the second question. How can we localize the particles in a region? And there's also, which operators do we have? don't have von Neumann's collapse scheme in general. In fact, I don't know any measurement in which the state before and after the measurement is exactly the same, and that includes doing things with projections. But as we have found, there's a great deal of benefit in choosing these operators to be positive. Well, that brings up another question. What's the status of the Stern-Gerlach experiment, for example, or any experiment for that matter?
I'm not really following you. Projection operators are a special case of positive operators, so I don't understand why you're including them when you don't have them.
The projection operators are something that you get out of von Neumann's analysis, and that requires that when you have done a measurement, immediately after, if you do another one, you'll get this exactly the same property. Well, I don't know of any system that has that property.
Well, filtering type measurement is an example.
Yeah, send a horizontally polarized photon through a horizontal polarization filter. Send it through three of them.
There is always a slight but definite probability that your photon won't go through.
These can be made arbitrarily small. I mean, that's experimental precision. There's no reason why you can't remove that to whatever accuracy is required for the experiment.
I have done the following experiment. I take two pieces of polarized film, and I have them at the cross purposes. And then I hold it up to the sun. And sure enough, a little bit of light leaks through.
But those are not, first of all, the filters that you're using are not, I mean, we're not talking about single photons here. I'm talking about a single photon experiment. Mm-hmm. Not an experiment where you have a mixture.
Okay. Maybe with single photon experiments of the type that you're describing, maybe there are really projection operators. But I doubt it. If M is a positive operator, then 3A remains the same, and 3B is occasionally wrong. What if the experiment, for example, destroys the state? Can we compute?
If the experiment destroys the state, your operators don't sum to the identity, they just sum to something less than the identity.
Not necessarily, but it's conceivable that that's.
I want to know, what do you mean by destroys the state?
A photon count destroys the state.
Take a.
What do you mean?
Photon absorbed. Photon detector.
Yeah.
You get an electric pulse. Measured some outcome, this actual photon state is destroyed.
well, I guess the photon still has, I guess, is there still a photon? I mean, okay, if you're going to talk about creating and annihilating particles, if we're going to, but, you know, we're not even in infinite dimensions, much less in Fock space yet. And actually, Fock space can help with a lot of these things. So that's why I want to ask, what you mean you destroyed state. Is there still a photon, and if so, does it have a state, some state?
Photons are rather the exception. You can really destroy a photon by absorbing it in an atom or such.
Okay, so let's take a spin 1/2 particle.
Massive, but then you don't have the property that the state is destroyed. Anyway.
But if you're going to destroy states, then I think you really need to be using Fock space. So it's not going to be invested in the information.
You will perhaps like the solution. Can we compute the results based on the probabilities and the dynamics alone? Maybe. Okay. Before I discuss anything further, I would like to give you a definition. And that is of informational completeness. You take a collection of self-adjoint operators, and they're said to be informationally complete if and only if, whenever you have two density operators, rho and rho prime, then the trace of rho against A alpha equaling the trace of rho prime A alpha for all alpha is equivalent to stating that rho equals rho prime. The spectral projectors for momentum are not informationally complete. The spectral projectors for position are not informationally complete, and the union of those two sets is not informationally complete. But that is what you have been taught by all your experience in undergraduate physics. Prokopecky gave explicit counterexamples.
Well, I mean, saying what we were taught, I mean, because all of them are orthogonal. I mean, it's clear some, you know, if you've got a commuting set of operators, they're only going to give you the same diagonal, and that doesn't determine a density matrix.
Mm-hmm. That's what's going on.
But that's what we were taught.
I don't know who was taught this.
Yeah.
You were taught well. What set of operators is informationally complete? You're suggesting that all the joint operators might be complete. Well, they are. Take any set that's informationally complete, and then you may take a finite set of these to approximate the equality of states. That's a reasonable way to proceed.
Sorry, you mean a finite subset of a complete set? What do you mean by?
If the set is obvious, what its physical interpretation is, then when you take just a finite set, you know what you're doing.
Well, if we're working on a finite Hilbert space to start.
No, not necessarily.
I thought that was axiom one.
Why a finite dimensional Hilbert space?
There are some systems which are modeled, some degrees of freedom are modeled by finite dimensional Hilbert space. I meant to take issue with that in the first slide, which is that I don't think they meant to imply that any degree of freedom can be modeled by finite dimensional Hilbert space, but clearly that some degrees of freedom can be, and that's cases of interest that they're being considered.
As long as those degrees of freedom don't interfere with the, say, the spin.
Well, the spin is a finite dimensional. You mean as long as the other degrees of freedom don't interfere?
Spin is not something that you simply add on at the end, relativistically. I will talk to you later about that.
Well, I was going to wait, but I think this idea that the quantum computation is using a finite dimensional Hilbert space. I mean, I think degree of freedom is really the right word here, because when, you know, people write down alleged states in finite dimensional systems and they're doing quantum computing, they also think, say, like things like the state in Alice's lab and the state in Bob's lab. Okay? So they don't write, you know, like a chemist, what an arrow or an alpha, I forget, chemist and physicists do, times, or it could be a more times some, you know, wave function in an infinite dimensional Hilbert space, but clearly when they make such a statement, you know, it's just a question of cleaning up the notation when you only write the spin part of it. Any statement like in Alice's lab, in Bob's lab, has an implicit wave function in the larger Hilbert space.
Yes. When you take the wave function in the larger space and then project it down into the lab with just spin, you may not find that it's in an eigenstate of spin.
It'll be a density matrix. It'll be some.
I wrote a FISREV letter about this. But in any case, that's clearly not a closed system.
Yes.
And I mean,
it's not a closed system.
And so your dynamics is not given by unitary effort. That's why people in quantum information don't.
Okay. Simply taking the tensor product of states, obtained multi-particle states, is contrary to entanglement. Entanglement occurs in a certain subspace of the tensor product.
No, it's not a subspace. You can take a superposition of two entangled states and get a product state.
That is a trivial subspace. The entangled.
The set of entangled states spans the space. It doesn't form a subspace. You can span C2 tensor T C2 with four entangled states.
I don't know that that's true.
Well,
that whenever you have entangled states, there are clearly coherent states, and you have both of those in the tensor problem.
Well, if you just take C2 tensor C2, you could expand that with the four Bell states.
And you get up, up, down, down, 1/2, one over the square root of 2, up, down, minus, down, up. That's entangled. And you also get 1 over the square root of 2, up, down, plus, down, up.
Yes, and you take plus or minus the last two, and they will span the same space as up, down, and down, up.
This is a state of spin zero. This is a state of spin zero. And this is a state, these are all states of spin one.
Yeah.
So how can you get this from even all three of those? You can't.
Do you have some super selection rule here?
That's under rotations. But the answer is that we can handle that entirely. You don't just want to have this. And you can handle that with the same analysis that you can handle that.
Well, what is axiom 4? I mean, axiom 4 means that what's the content of axiom 4? That if you have n systems, then the states live are just the separable states. I mean, they're not just
They're not just separable states.
So axiom 4 is clearly that's wrong.
That's what Nielsen and Chuang say.
Of course, I mean, this is obviously wrong.
Mm-hmm. Okay. I'm going to proceed in the mindset of Eugene Vigor. He had a way of deriving physics. He said, take a group that's a group of symmetries for your system, turn the crank, and mathematically, then you get everything. And that's what I'm going to do with the Poincaré group or the Galilei group. Then I'll derive the phase spaces, not completely from the group setting. I will get the irreducible representations completely from the group setting, etc. And if you want to find that somewhere, that's in my book. The way that you get a phase space is, roughly speaking, the following. Take the Lie group. Derive the Lie algebra from it. Compute everything in the cohomology of it, at least up to the second cohomology. Pick a vector in what's called the second cohomology. And then you will eventually get a phase space from anything that's in Z2 of G. Take the quotient of the original group with this, you have to go from this subtly algebra to a group itself, and then you take the quotient of these two lead groups to get a phase space. Then take L2 of this phase space. Then decompose this phase space. That's clearly not an irreducible representation. But when you decompose it, all the representations of quantum mechanics come out. Well, I haven't bothered to put all of that down. One not surprising representation is that topologically, the phase spaces we get from massive spinning particles are these, and massive zero spin particles are those. Okay. We take a box delta 1 in phase space. Well, box delta 1 is a box in momentum space, and box 2 is in position space. And take a particle with wave function eta that has those properties, translate it with the representation of the group, so you get that. Take the probability for localization operator for any vector to be in delta 1 cross delta 2 to be the following. This is very plausible, because you have just the translation, and so this is an integral of these single transition probabilities over whatever the boxes are. The only question is, what is zeta? You have a great deal of freedom in choosing eta. There are some constraints on it, but for the most part, you can take anything. Take the operator for localization to be the following, and then you have the realization that the characteristic function is something that is an L1 and an L infinity. You can use some measure theory to show that you can equally easily treat this as a eta of f, because you might take the sums. and add them, and you'll get the eta of the corresponding C1 times delta, chi delta 1, and so forth. These A etas, surprisingly, are informationally complete. That's also true of the Heisenberg group, which is the thing that I, why I referred to taking the position and the momentum as being informationally complete. Now you want to spectrally decompose this operator. What do you find? You find that the spectrum is purely discrete whenever you started out with a compact set. Ordering the spectrum in a decreasing order, you find that you have something close to 1, strictly less than 1, and then a very rapid drop off, and then something that's close to but not quite 0. Well, this is the answer to questions 1, 2, and 3. Six. You start with the informationally complete set, and then you truncate it in the natural basis you get from the localization. And to localize the particle, you choose just the eigenvectors that correspond to the eigenvalues that are close to 1. You have a similar argument for any f that is in L1 intercept L infinity. By comparison, take a system of P and Q, and you don't have informational completeness at the start with just doing the measurements of P or the measurements of Q. So take the measurements of Q and restrict the spectrum to a compact set. Is the operator purely discrete? No. The phase space is much different. Now, let's go to questions 3 and 4. Which unitary operators, or which operators at all, or without using the projection postulate, can we get the result? Look first of all at the full space space. Get the Hamiltonian dynamics. Then take the projection onto the unitary operator of that unitary operator on the part of phase space being considered. And then take the partial trace to get what we have to discuss for a theory based on just the momentum or just the position or just the spin. we don't get unitary dynamics. There's an alternative. Well, the only question is how far do the operators we get diverge from this measurement of unitary operators? For position and momentum, we don't really get much. That has to do with what the variance is for a particle waveform. It's very small. The spin is a different story. You can record the spin by comparing it with the spin in a known direction. This will lead you to essentially the law of malice. And if you have some leakage, there's a slight variation on the law of malice use. And that takes you from projection value to positive operator value measures. If you have just kicked it slightly in terms of the momentum, what is the deviation for the spin? Well, initially it's essentially one, and then it very rapidly goes down because of the law of malice. Two examples. Take the Stern-Gerlach example. There you have a collimator, and that's followed by a magnet, that's followed by a screen. Well, we did a lot of investigation of this, and we found that when you have a spot up and a spot down, if you measure something in the spot up, it has a 1 in 25 probability of being spin down. The result of this analysis is that spin is not a quantity that really has an eigenfunction. It's an eigenfunction of any projection, in this experiment at least. You have similar discussion of any beam splitters or anything. For those of you that don't know what a qubit is, it's an element of a two-dimensional vector space. Okay, I'll call that space H0 and choose an orthogonal basis that I'll call 0 and 1. Quantum computing is done by various and sundry things. CNOT gate is supposed to take a controlled qubit and a target qubit. And if the target And if the control is in state zero, then the target is left alone. If the control is in the state one, then the target is flipped. This transition may be discussed by a unitary operator in H0. But having a system with only two states is just an approximation. And the unitary operator that you have on that two-state system doesn't come from a Hamiltonian dynamics. How does it go? You consider the state of control and or the target as functions of P, Q, and S. And the Hamiltonian as functions of the appropriate corresponding operators. As states evolve, they undergo a wave function spreading. And this is a small spreading for usually in terms of Q, but it will change the direction of P slightly. And let's change the spin, which will have a drastic effect on the the cosine of the angle that's changing. You also have the problem that you don't expect this operator to cause you to go from one state to another state that's orthogonal to it exactly.
You could replace xenon by swap, which is more familiar to physicists do swap all the time.
You swap approximately. I will grant you that. If you have prepared a state in pure the zero operation. Well, how can you do that? And then you claim that you have a state that's pure one. How can you justify that? Well, maybe you will have a great probability for that, but it's a probability. And the state is in the spin direction. And the spin, as we've seen in the Stern-Gerlach device, may be something that's not just simply one state.
The Stern-Gerlach device is looking at free electrons. A better model, one which I think is not perfect, would be, let's take an atom in a magnetic field.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? You can be in an there's no problem being in an eigenstate of that Hamiltonian. It has discrete eigenvalues. There's no spreading of the wave pack.
I think you and I will have to discuss after the talk.
So you don't agree that there are eigenstates of an atom in a magnetic field?
No, they're just approximate. That's my view.
Okay.
Your magnetic field isn't exactly one direction either. And that
doesn't actually matter.
Well, in any event, the transition we get looks about like that, where This is the unitary time evolution. Delta is a set for localizing the particle in the full phase space before evolution. And delta prime is for localizing after evolution. Then that's M, which isn't a unitary operator in the original Hilbert space. That answers question four. Positively. Well, then you have question five. Let me only say that with the Stern-Gerlach example, you might put a hole in the screen right exactly at the spot that you expect the things to go up into.
One doesn't do quantum computing with a Stern-Gerlach experiment. You do quantum computing with ion traps. Quantum dots.
Okay. But this is just an example of another system. It's not, I agree, an example from quantum computing. You can get the a Stern-Gerlach device beyond it, right through the hole, direct a second one, and you can do another measurement. Then you get a longer string of things. And after that, you can take the probability, but you don't consider what the Stern-Gerlach device is doing, either the first one or maybe not the second. In conclusion, you have to look a little deeper into the theory of measurement if you really want to get a true measurement scheme of a particle and then what it has gone into. That requires some type of recording. And you have Shor's algorithm that's based on unitary dynamics and on projections and so forth. What will happen? You expect that it will go to a theory that is very close to Shor's theorem, but not quite. And what will happen if you have a series of these things, spin one half, spin one half, spin one half, and you you might be able to get something that is a limit on the precision, the limit as a function of the number of particles. And maybe that's what we run into. Why there isn't a true quantum computer with 25 spins. Thank you.
Well, I'm not sure that the ion trap people could make a 25-bit quantum computer if they wanted to. But as far as the, I mean, the fact that people choose to sometimes describe things in terms of a subsystem doesn't mean they don't know that there's a larger system. And anyone who works with noise in quantum computing knows full well that looking at a subsystem is not a unitary operation. That doesn't mean that you can't, now, there are certainly going to be always be problems with experimental position, but you can't have unitary gates acting on a subsystem. I think the subsystem is the least of the problems. The fact is that you have to turn the gates on and off, so you are looking at Hamiltonian dynamics ultimately, and you know some of the other there are other models take that into account more fully. I mean, you haven't mentioned, for example, Davis Lewis. Approach to the quantum theory of open systems.
Mm-hmm. Yes, I know that I haven't, but the Davis book, the work of Palevo, the work of everybody that has delved into this in the earlier years, we have considered all of them, and the fact is that we don't get any immediate contradictions. There are various contradictions that we anticipate getting, but mostly it's a computational nightmare. What do you do with the fact that you don't have a pure magnetic field? Well, we had to look at a realistic magnetic field and turn the crank and do all the computation. And then with the spin orbit interaction, etc., we got something. But it was a lot of work. There is a lot of work to do in what I've uncovered today. Why do you think that there's no effect of this region propagating to this region? Well, you have Hegerfield's theorem, and that's something that we have talked about. Hegerfield, when I originally asked him about it, said that there was no contradiction with the physics on the phase space. So that was great. I proceeded for about 10 years, and then he published another paper. And now it's a question again. The question of whether you have even a local theory at all is maybe only an approximation. After all, this eta is a wave function for a particle. And if that goes down but extends out to infinity.
It doesn't need to extend out to infinity. You can, I mean, everything is an approximation.
Yeah.
Can we agree? There's no such thing as an isolated hydrogen atom.
Okay.
But they, you don't even have to extend out to infinity. In fact, it was the first paper I, published in this field, so in which I explicitly addressed the question you started with. And, you know, when people say things like you have, you know, a qubit in Alice's lab or a state in Bob's lab, they're implicitly assuming a spatial wave function. Now, all of the quantum computing algorithms assume, you know, they talk, you know, 25 qubits, okay, you have qubits, that you can identify the qubits. Now, if these are formed from identical electrons, which are identical particles, of course you can't. So what does this really mean? Well, what it really means is that there is, in fact, a spatial, you know, you have to say ion track here, there's a spatial wave function that says that there is an electron in this track. Okay, and after you take all of these tensor products, you have to anti-symmetrize the whole thing. And there's a FISRAP letter in which I worked this out for the simplest case. And this doesn't even give you, because the initial states are entangled, it doesn't even give you a completely positive map. But precisely because the Coulomb interaction is long range, the wave functions can be compactly supported. But those are not eigenstates, okay, of any system interacting with Coulomb interactions.
So and so what does compactly supported mean?
It's in a finite region.
Okay.
So because the Coulomb interaction is long range, they don't even have to overlap. Okay, those will not be eigenstates of any Hamiltonian with Coulomb interactions. And of course, and over time, okay, and then when you measure, you'll get a different result. Okay, and people worry about that. That's why they talk about decoherence times. That's why they want to try to parallelize quantum algorithms and things like that. But actually, I recommend this paper to your attention. I'll give you a copy of it.
Okay.
But I think what is confusing here, bona fide experimental errors and approximations with the people are well aware of taking into account with, you know, attempts to say that even the model Hamiltonian, so to speak, doesn't have eigenstates, or the people don't. I mean, people get a great deal out of studying model Hamiltonians,
yes,
and they can give you very good approximations to physical systems.
Mm-hmm. The intent of this was to get a handle on how much this theory differed from the original theory. You have an ideal, and you have what we consider reality. Maybe in certain experiments, you can use just the pure state, the projections, and so forth. But that will only be true if the theory with all these distributions converges in that case.
But if you do the experiment and it works?
You are familiar with a paper by Clouder and Russ Guy, in which they took a system and looked at the perturbations of the system, and then when they turned the perturbation off, they didn't get the same thing. I suggest you go read that paper.
But those were not arbitrary perturbations.
Yeah.
They were chosen to be pathological perturbations.
Yep.
Okay, maybe we could continue this debate later. I'll quickly ask, are there any other questions? Otherwise, I can invite the speaker again.